Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film. Welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our production editor and contributor, Erlinga Ennison.
Hello.
Hello. And our contributor, Musana Ahmed.
Hello.
Hello, hello, and welcome to this week. We're going to be talking I Care A Lot, Music, Barb and Star Go to Del Mar, and Pelé. But quickly before we get onto that, who's seen WandaVision and what are your theories?
Yes. Oh, theories. You know, it's hard to say because it seems so neatly divided between 9 episodes. Like, there's clearly a 3-act structure going on here, and we've just reached the end of the second act.
Yeah.
Where the line between reality and Wanda's imagination in this sitcom is becoming really blurred now, especially with the events with Vision stepping outside of the bubble. I'm not entirely sure what will happen. All I know is Elizabeth Olsen said something about how we should expect like a big Mandalorian level cameo in the final episode.
Ooh, who's it going to be?
For me, I have 3 ideas in mind. Number one, Magneto, who's the obvious because of the X-Men connection.
Yeah.
Number two, Doctor Strange, because of the multiverse of madness, which is coming up. And the third one is also a multiverse one, and that's Spider-Man. But it's going to be Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man, I think.
Wow. I mean, what if you get all 3?
That'd be beyond any television budget, I think.
Yeah. What about you, Erlinga? What are you thinking about it at the moment?
I've just been enjoying it as a fan. It's really fun just looking into all these like almost conspiracy theories about what's happening. And especially what caught my attention was when Monica Rambeau said, I know an aerospace engineer who might be interested or something like that. And since then, I've just been trying to will Reed Richards into this.
Yeah.
From the Fantastic Four, because they are developing a film on them. The Fantastic Four, they really need to be done justice for once.
Yes, you know, they haven't had the right movie yet, have they?
Yeah, it kind of adds up logically. But then, you know, my hit record with predicting things in these shows is woefully low. So it's probably going to be something else. I hadn't made the Doctor Strange connection. That might be very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's like there's so many Easter eggs as you go along. I think I've got quite a few of them. And then I go online and I'm like, missed a ton. So God knows, you could never predict which way it's going.
My question for you, Erlinga, is if Reed Richards does show up, do you support the fan casting of John Krasinski?
He's into it.
I do like that, yeah. They would have to get Emily Blunt as Sue Storm, wouldn't they?
It could work because she hasn't occupied a role in the MCU yet.
Yeah.
I think they were both into it because I remember way back, if you recall, in the before times when A Quiet Place 2 was going to come out, I asked him whether he'd be into that and he was really quite chuffed with the idea and quite liked it and quite liked the idea of him and Emily occupying those roles. So I could see it. I'd quite like to see Emily Blunt in a superhero costume doing her thing. We've seen her in The Edge of Tomorrow. She can do that action and all that stuff. I could really see it. I like it. We'll have to wait and see, won't we? Let's see this week what Marvel brings us. Shall we move on to what delights we've got to watch this week? Let's start off with this.
My name is Marla Grayson. I'm just someone who cares.
Marla Grayson, you've had amazing success. What's your secret?
There is no secret, Peter.
She forces them into the home, auctions off their house,
and uses the proceeds to pay herself.
Because caring is my job. I will grab your dick and balls, and I will rip them clean off.
All right, so that is I Care A Lot. Who cares a lot, Erlinga?
Rosamund Pike does. Yes. She plays Marla Grayson, who runs a company of sorts that takes care of people who can no longer take care of themselves or have been deemed not to be able to take care of themselves by the state. We find out very early on that she is not entirely honest, say the least.
No.
She works with doctors and healthcare professionals to have rich people, especially, deemed unable to take care of themselves. So they are put into her care and she becomes their legal guardian, at which point she starts to bleed them dry through legal but morally baseless ways. I found it a fascinating movie because you start off with an entirely unlikable character doing an entirely unlikable thing, and you think it's going to go one way, but then it twists and you get more unlikable people.
I mean, there isn't a likable person in this, is there? There's nobody with a moral high ground. Everybody's awful.
And I find films like that fascinating. I can enjoy movies where I hate everyone. And this is definitely a movie where you hate everyone.
Is that the Icelander in you? Just misery?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Make it bleak.
Exactly. It's my Nordic noir
fan.
But you find yourself weirdly starting to root for Marla. And that is entirely down to Rosamund Pike's performance, I think. She is a power throughout that film.
Yeah, she describes herself as a lioness. And really, this is a lioness performance for me. I know that you were not as keen, Masana. What problems did you have with it?
I think it had a really good foundation. Like, it established her as this really irreverent, cheeky character, and she sort of gets to flex the muscles she built on Gone Girl, but goes into entirely new territory here as well, I think. But then at some point, when they set up the conflict between her and the gangsters who are led by Peter Dinklage, it feels a bit more binary to me at that point, until the third act, which is quite surprising in where it goes in terms of the whole morality play. But the journey there, it just doesn't have the same sort of emotional odyssey or the pulsating tension of a Safdie Brothers or a Coen Brothers film, which to me it feels most clearly inspired by. And despite sharing a similar high concept, crime-centered premise, I really think that it could have afforded to be a lot more humorous than it promises in the early minutes. You know, Netflix have billed it as a comedy, and I think it exercises its funny bone to a very inadequate extent, I think.
Really? Because I found it really deliciously tickling throughout. You know, what she does with a pint of milk even made me laugh, which we won't give away. I disagree with you, I'm afraid. I'm with Erlinger on this. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I found it a hoot and sort of thrilling to see a woman behave like this as well. I think it is interesting that the main three people that this centres on really are women who you wouldn't expect to have power. You know, you've got Rosamund Pike and her girlfriend played by Aiza Gonzalez, and then Diane West as the sort of lady that they're trying to pull into their scheme, but who has a surprising secret that will somewhat kaput that. I think it's just very interesting to see that, and they're all unapologetic in the way that they behave. I loved it.
That's the thing. It's unapologetic. It's wielding power. I mean, we've seen films where women have power, but it's the way that Pike's character wields it in this film that really grabbed me. When you see a great female performance by an actress, you know, the natural place to go and compare it to is a Helen Mirren or a Meryl Streep, you know, the regal presences in female acting. And my brain always plays the recasting game when I'm watching a film, like going, ooh, who else could do this in the way that this actor is doing it? And throughout this film, I never got a Helen Mirren or a Meryl Streep or anything like that from Rosamund Pike. She's doing a De Niro or a Christian Bale, where she has that alluring charm, but a simmering danger underneath it, simmering menace, because she's a predator. She is taking traits in this film that traditionally belong to male actors and strong male actors in cinema. She uses it in a way that doesn't reduce it to a femme fatale or a butch femme. She wields it while retaining all that feminine charm as well, all those feminine traits as well. And I found that quite unique. Yeah. In Pike's performance.
I love the way that, you know, she can vape like Lauren Bacall. When she's tied in a chair in a situation where she's about to be killed, she's as slippery as, you know, anybody, any major action hero. It is caricaturey, obviously, because the situation is heightened. I well believe that there are people like this, you know, just playing the American healthcare system. So that in itself is also quite chilling to watch as well.
I don't have a problem with thoroughly unlikable or unsympathetic characters, but it definitely makes it a little bit harder to engage with. So you can say the ultimate point of a film could be it has to move you, it has to emotionally grab you. And I wasn't gripped in that respect by this particular film. I sort of was left at the end of it saying, you know, I appreciate the performance, I appreciate the filmmaking, but I'm not necessarily sure the story did anything for me.
But it's interesting that it's made by the same guy who made The Disappearance of Alice Creed. Oh, yeah. And this is only his second film. And it's been a while since Alice Creed, but Alice Creed sort of did the similar thing of sort of challenging your notion of what women on screen do and their moral ambiguity. And I think it's just a really interesting project. And frankly, I love Rosamund Pike. I loved her in Gone Girl. And I love seeing her step into the similar waters here. I just think she's really incredible actress. I also interviewed her, full disclosure, for a Total Film interview recently, which I found fascinating, and her process is amazing. She can be all sorts of things, and she's really actually quite chameleon. I think she demonstrates that in this film as well, because she has this dazzling smile when she turns up on people's doorsteps. Hi, I'm here to help. She can be an absolute terrier when she's backed into a corner. She's, you know, a romantic in a couple with her girlfriend, and she can be romantic and strong. She can be vulnerable. She can be all of these things. And also, I have to say, she looks amazing in it. Her costumes, her wardrobe, and her haircut is just perfect for this character, as sharp as she is, just this bob that is razor sharp and these beautifully cut clothes. I loved everything about it.
I do think it's cool to see her being recognized for her efforts with a Golden Globe nomination, especially yeah. because they made so many blunders this year, I think. We'll get
Which
to
we'll
that
be
later
getting
on
to, yes.
Yeah. It was a very good performance, that's for sure. Personally, after I saw the film, I thought, okay, maybe this is just for the diehards, the Dinklage heads, the Pike heads, whatever the fan bases of these actors call themselves.
Pike but, heads. I love it. There you go.
But listening to you two really find yourself immersed in the film, I think, okay, it probably has a lot wider appeal than I expected.
I totally get people who don't engage with the film, because it is very hard to like anyone. It is a natural process to want to like someone. And yeah, it doesn't have the same airtight quality as a Safdie Brothers film, for example, you know, where there's not a pocket of air anywhere. You know, there are moments there, but I still found it very, very entertaining.
In the days when the only things we're hearing about healthcare are grim, 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 it's sort of a bit of a relief to see something that has a bit of dark black humour in it, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm willing to put like the lowest odds possible that when it rolls out, we're just going to get tweets of that just tweaked the title. I cared a lot. I didn't care. I cared very little.
Yeah.
It just seems like the easiest possible response
okay,
you can give to
so,
that.
So, I mean,
film.
I think Erling Goraier, we cared a lot.
I cared a bit.
Okay, so there you go. That's for your poster. That's I Care a Lot, which hits Netflix from the 19th. All right, so let's move on from one type of caring to another.
She sees the world in a completely different way from us.
We're about to have a pool party.
I am happy.
So this is Music, Sia's film that has got quite a bit of controversy. Why, Masana?
It all begins with the casting of Maddie Ziegler, who is an able-bodied actress who is not on the autism spectrum as far as we know, but she is playing a non-verbal autistic character in this film. Straight from the first few moments of the film, you can see it is very caricaturistic of non-verbal autistic people's behavior. Then when you watch the story, you start to realize how Sia never really had a very strong intent for what she's trying to represent by featuring an autistic person at the center of her story. It's just an absolutely abhorrent film for so many reasons.
Straight out the gate. I mean, let's discuss what it's actually about for people sure. who don't know. Kate Hudson plays a recovering sort of addict whose sister is this girl that you're discussing, whose grandmother who has cared for her dies suddenly, leaving her in charge of her. It's basically a sort of weird redemption story, isn't it? About Kate Hudson's character being redeemed by her autistic sister and the magical man that lives next door with a health problem. So anyone who has an issue in this film is basically in service to this able character who happens to have a drugs issue. It's a really misguided film, isn't it?
I mean, let's take it further to why it's abhorrent. I mean, you mentioned that the next door neighbor who Kate Hudson's character lives with is a magical man, and it's played by Leslie Odom Jr., who plays an African man. So they're going back to this outdated trope of the magical black man, which was in so many old films, such as The Green Mile, for example, The Shawshank Redemption, where, you know, they kind of save the white character in that way. The fact that she has to rely on the outdated trope, as well as just casting Maddie Ziegler in the role, my skin was crawling in the first few minutes because the artifice of the film was just so clear. Yeah. But you know what else is worse is that the film is also very much a domestic drama. It's about the relationship and the arc of Kay Hudson's recovering drug addict. All those scenes are so lifeless. They're so boring. So not only is it cringe, it's just
it is boring. Dull. Yeah. What did you think, Erlinger?
I agree with you. It's a hugely problematic portrayal of autism. I've got a nephew who is on the spectrum. I mean, he's high functioning. He's not nonverbal like Maddie Ziegler's character. It feels uncomfortable. Mm. It feels uncomfortable from the opening scene. And as you watch it, it doesn't get any better, unfortunately, because even though you start to recognize none of this is done with ill intent, and to Sia's credit, she has acknowledged that this casting choice was wrong and that she got bad advice in her preparation for that film. But you should be able to spot that yourself. You should be able to spot that what you're doing is not a celebration of autism in an ableist world. It's autism cosplay. That's what's happening there. Poor Maddie Ziegler, she does her best with what she's given. I enjoyed Sia's music and I enjoy Maddie Ziegler. She was in the Chandelier video, wasn't she?
Yes, and she's done a lot of stuff. Projects with
Sia. Yeah, there's too much problematic stuff in there. There's, yeah, like you spotted, Musana, the magical African man. There's these tropes that they just fell through the cracks of everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
making this film.
It's almost like Tropic Thunder, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, except it's not knowing.
And exactly. That, you know, there's this entire sequence of, you know, Ben Stiller having played this particular character to get an Oscar. And we've moved beyond that from, you know, Rain Man and various other roles like this. You know, these people are not there to just prop up an able-bodied person. We thought we'd move beyond that. But this film is so backward, isn't it?
Yeah.
But point out that there's these deeply uncomfortable sequences where they have to restrain music. Mm. And I read online, you can see a lot of responses on social media by autistic people who talk about how those sequences are actually quite dangerous because they can really, you know, suffocate the person when you lay on them like that. And I believe Sia said she was going to re-edit those for the final release.
Yeah, we saw the version that had those in, so they may not be there if you choose to watch this, but they are problematic.
Perhaps that's an outcome of working with Autism Speaks, who are apparently a polarizing organization for their intentions. Supposedly, they want to seek a cure for autism. Well, I want to seek a cure for watching this film.
But yeah, what about the... I mean, obviously, one of the things that it's sort of traded on a lot is the musical sequences, which are very pastel, bright, crazy costumes, very sort of expressive faces and dancing around to these tunes. Did that lift it at all? I mean, for me, it was just like... why didn't you just release those as music videos and be done with it? Like, I don't need the film around this.
I think it had honest intentions and like, I want to make an entire feature film that celebrates, you know, the spirit of whatever she's trying to say, which is never really clear, but it never works. Because even if you take away all the problematic elements, even if you take away the fact that a neurotypical person is playing a nonverbal autistic, if you take away the racial stereotypes, if you take away
the boringness,
all of that, if you take away all of that, is it a good film? No, it's poorly paced. The direction is uneven. Kate Hudson, she struggles mightily to find any tone for her character. Mm. You know, even if you don't think about the way that everyone else is seemingly written in to redeem her, she struggles within herself to find the character, find any tone, any consistency. It's boring.
And also... Sia puts herself in it with a really, that like,
cameo was
God, please make it end. It's astonishing, actually. It's a film that's quite interesting to watch, actually, just from a point of view of how did this get funding? There are, you know, people with great ideas, first-time filmmakers, who would make amazing films given this much budget and casting and all of the access that Sia's got. She apparently had nobody watching Rushes and going, Do you think that maybe this? And to me, it's a massive folly that's not only got past Sia, but also, you know, the studio and everybody in the process, when at no point has anybody gone, I think maybe you want to rethink this. So from that point of view, it's quite interesting to see a film that has literally slipped through all of those nets that are usually such a sort of roadblock for people trying to get movies made.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Music has been nominated for Golden Globes. How has this happened?
I can't believe it, because the whole arc of Kay Hudson is just so boring. And I don't understand what sort of energy or spirit the scene had performance to nominate her for one, to nominate the film for anything else, because it has zero merit.
It's certainly not Kate Hudson's best work. Maybe she's getting a nomination for shaving a head. I don't know.
It seems to be a golden ticket for a lot of nominations to like radically alter your physical appearance. It doesn't cut it this time. And Kate Hudson is a good actress, but this is not her best performance.
No. Bob and Star had way better musical sequences. If only it was released a little bit earlier, then it would have been eligible.
Yes, agree. It should have been indeed.
I just want to say one thing for the listeners. If you are ever curious of watching this film and you want the best experience of it, I would suggest purchasing Sia's famous blonde wig, which covers your eyes, and putting that on after you press play.
And with that ringing endorsement, I think we'll leave it there. I think it's pretty clear that this is not our favourite for this week, but it is available on all digital platforms now, should you want to wear a wig whilst watching it. Possibly earplugs too, who knows. Guys, it's time to grab your culottes. It's time for this.
I'm Barb, and this is Star.
Room number again, please, sir.
611.
611? Oh, my... Barb.
Oh, my gosh, he's 611.
611? We're in 124.
So this is Barb and Star go to Vista Del Mar. It does what it says on the tin, but what else is going on?
This is just pure absurd comedy, and I loved it.
What a palate cleanser from music, right?
What a palate cleanser. Yeah, so these two friends, exactly what it says on the tin, they go to Vista Del Mar, which I believe is in Florida, and they have one hell of a journey there. You know, I don't even know if I should give the parallel narrative of away, because it's something that they withheld in the trailer. It was something that was just completely took me off guard. And I think that's the strength of the film, is that there's so many unexpected gags. The strength of it is that it catches you off guard with its transitions and juxtapositions, and all of that begins with a really disarming intro in which you see a young paperboy who's listening to Barbra Streisand and completing his rounds, and then he inexplicably descends into a secret lair, and then from there it just gets weirder and weirder. And it has such a vibrant production design that you want to pause and you'll see humor in the furniture or the clothes and just about everything else in the frame. And it's not even just the visual gags, I think. It's like the things in the audio that made me laugh, like the dance remix of My Heart Will Go On and the songs by the lounge player Richard Cheese.
The booby song.
The booby song. It's really special. And a few years ago, I had seen the film Greener Grass, which was an indie comedy. Mm-hmm. And that was an absurd comedy set in the suburbs. When I saw that film, I thought it was head and shoulders above all the studio films I had seen over the last few years, maybe since Pop Star Never Stopped Never Stopping. And I just wanted mainstream studios to take more risks like that in terms of just nonsensical comedy, but that does actually make a lot of sense and is really strong in it hitting its satirical targets. And this was the closest I've got to a mainstream film doing what Greener Grass did,
good,
I think.
That's a good comparison.
I compare it to Austin Powers for obvious reasons, multiple roles being played by Kristen Wiig, who also wrote this with Annie Mumolo, and they together they wrote Bridesmaids. So this is basically their follow-up to Bridesmaids, and it couldn't be more different, could it?
I am very glad that you loved the film.
Uh-oh.
I'm very happy for you. For me, it was a Saturday Night Live sketch drawn out across 100 minutes. Oh, but the good thing is that people who love this movie and people who this movie is aimed at do not care what I think about it. Me, a random film critic on a podcast, because it is aimed at a very specific audience and it does it very, very well. And I found a lot of it entertaining. And people have been criticizing Jamie Dornan's character online,
what?
I've seen.
I
yes,
loved
I know.
Jamie.
I know. I loved him.
Star in this.
Yeah,
I wish loved he brought this much commitment to his other roles.
Exactly.
His relationship with Kristen Wiig was a better love story than Fifty Shades of Grey.
Yeah, and sexier.
100%.
And they 100%. Had clots involved.
And that was my favourite part of the film, is that whole kind of like farce-like relationship that they enjoy with that weird third wheel that Annie Mumolo provides to those proceedings. Interestingly, same colour palette as music, yes. Same pastel palette, but much better utilised. And the thing is, I never found it boring, but I don't think I laughed out loud more than once or twice, personally.
I don't understand. I think you needed a drink with a small umbrella in it to help you on your way or something. Because, you know, not to give away any spoilers, but there was a joke about driving and how people drive in movies that I had to pause the film because it made me laugh so much. You know, there's a crustacean that made me laugh. The fact that...
A sneezing gag.
A banana boat that's called a tit flapper. Just stupid things. And that's the thing that I thought was so great about it, was I could watch this numerous times and find different things funny. Like you said, Masana, like just looking at the stuff in the background, just things like I found the fact that they make a hot dog soup, their signature dish, just funny.
Oh, yeah.
Lay on top of that, Jamie Dornan singing his heart out, a rock ballad on the beach, ripping his shirt, just giving it his all. I'm going to be watching it again as soon as possible.
That's the thing. I think it might be a grower for people who don't immediately love it, like me. Last year, we got the Eurovision movie, which is kind of a similar vein of silliness and absurdness. And after I watched it the first time, I was like, all right, that was okay. You know, felt a bit loose around the edges. But I've now watched that film four times because it becomes comfort watching. And I find it funnier now than when I watched it the first time. And this, I think, might be a similar type of film. I might have to give it another shot.
Yeah. And, you know, like things like Romeo and Michelle, no one really loved that film, but it became this cult classic. I could see this becoming a cult classic, couldn't you, Masana?
I was about to ask you both that question, actually. Based on the discussions I've seen online, including in reviews by major film outlets, it already seems to be gathering the cult status. People are already predicating it as it's going to be the hidden gem. It's going to be the thing that people don't discover till years later, like the films of The Lonely Island. I have two reasons in mind. Number one, because the VOD label means maybe less people will see it compared to if it went straight to streaming, because it has a fairly high price tag. You have to pay like $15.99 to watch it via iTunes or whatever. And secondly, the comedy requires you to be on a particular wavelength. So
it would be great to watch this in a cinema, wouldn't it?
Oh, with a 100%. Load of
people. I think it requires a communal experience, which is something we can't get at the moment for maximum enjoyment.
Could you not see this sort of playing on repeat at the Prince Charles Theatre, you know, and having Barb and Star evenings where they sell hot dog soup in the foyer and you come in culottes and you have an antidote with you, not to give anything
sing
away.
Sing along with Richard Cheese.
Sing along with Richard Cheese and his booby song. I could see it being a massive thing.
People forming their own talking clubs.
Talking club, very good. Yeah, I mean, see, you're already warming to it, even as you talk about it, Erlinger. You are.
I think you're winning me over.
I think you need to see it again and maybe rethink. But for now, you're saying recommendation?
100%, yes. And I'll say one other thing.
Yes.
Morgan Freeman.
Yes.
People learn about Morgan Freeman.
Yes. And Erlinger? Cautionary recommendation?
If you're in the mood for it, why not?
I'm totally 100% watch it. Barb and Star, Go to Vista Del Mar is available to rent now. Right, finally, let's move on and get match fit for this.
Pelé surge no momento em que o Brasil também surge como país moderno.
Ele adorava-se. Pelé.
A gente que imaginava que a democracia fosse perdurar. Infelizmente, não foi.
So this is Pelé, which is hitting Netflix. What's it about?
Well, it's about Pelé. To many, he is the greatest footballer who has ever lived. Brazilian footballing legend, played in 4 or 5 World Cups, won 3 of them, is the highest goal scorer in footballing history. And this is the film of him. Goes through his playing career from childhood to retirement and includes interviews with him today, as well as his ex-teammates, people who knew him personally or know him personally.
Did it interest you? Was it as interesting as watching him on the pitch?
There's always a danger when you do a documentary like that with an icon who is clearly heavily involved in the making of the film that it becomes a hero poem. Unfortunately for me, at times this fell into that category. There's fascinating newsreel footage and match footage for the football fans to enjoy throughout the film, but I don't think it will have the same cultural resonance as something like The Last Dance, which was about the Chicago Bulls in the 90s, and especially about Michael Jordan.
Or the Maradona documentary that we got last year, which was...
Exactly.
Masana, did you love it?
I thought it was okay. I mean, you just mentioned Maradona, and that is the obvious and inevitable point of comparison because both of them have been compared to each other so many times, Maradona and Pelé. However, the construction of his story is not nearly as compelling as what Asif Kapadia did with Diego Maradona. And honestly, nor is the character. With Maradona, we at least had cocaine and socialism. But in this film...
That's what you're demanding this... here. LA, do more cocaine.
But in this film, like, a journalist really tries to prime us by discussing the dictatorship in 60s Brazil. But we are told time and time again how Pelé was just so politically indifferent that every time they were like, so you don't actually know the truth behind Pelé. You know, if he never played in the 1970 World Cup, he might have been killed. Then it cut to Pelé and he'd be like, oh no, that wasn't really the case. I was actually just wanting to play because I'm competitive and, you know, I love representing Brazil. It shows how much he was a figure who was relied on for like kind of an escape from, you know, the dirty politics of the time. But I can honestly say that applies to every single athlete. Like you could say somebody like, you know, Tom Brady was a symbol for America being able to just take away their eyes from politics for a while and just engage with football. Or LeBron James, for instance, and basketball. There's every athlete is always going to represent their country in that way and be able to provide escapism for audiences. So I don't really think Pelé is unique in that way, but they really try to mine more drama than there actually is with the whole political element.
I did think that was a little bit different to, you know, your Tom Brady's or LeBron James's, that element of it. I thought it did succeed fairly well in highlighting how the national mood in Brazil seemed directly linked to the fortunes of its football team, like directly so. And because I'm a bit of a history geek as well, so I've been reading about in the past about like the Vargas era that turned into a dictatorship around the Second World War and the continuing turmoil after that in Brazil and South America at large. And football does exist on another plane to what we experience even here in England. It is a religion to so many people there, and it does highlight that to an extent. But well, I
wouldn't
also
that maybe
agree
have been the better documentary maybe about how strong football is and what football is to people in Brazil comparative to other countries. Yeah. It's not really about Pelé though, is it? It's just he happened to be the focus of that sort of joy that the nation...
Well, he becomes a messianic figure to these people. He becomes a savior to so many people. And I think what they were trying to highlight with the rise of a new fascist regime and his seeming indifference towards that, because he was well off, he was well treated by them. They understandably took it as, if we keep him happy, we have a good spokesperson.
It's a cognitive dissonance, though. It's like...
Yeah, it is.
He's on the side of the dictators in a way, but he's also supposed to be on the sides of the people who are rallying against the political figures.
Yeah, and he seems just quite opaque, doesn't he, throughout this. I felt like I knew nothing more about him, really, at the end of this than I did at the beginning.
No, because they're not willing to delve into the darkness of his character.
Yeah, they mentioned the affairs a little bit, but they only mention them. They don't really examine them. I'm actually grateful that it didn't go full hagiography and have a bunch of people from the modern day, like contemporary footballers and journalists who just gushed over however much he meant to them, because that's something you always see in sports documentaries. Instead, I think rightfully, they only devoted talking head time to the people who were there at the time, including his fellow football players, as well as some journalists who could provide the relevant historical context. And the best part of the film, I think, was the present day scene where they all meet together and they all
and
sit
still
down
got the
and have a little discussion. Yeah. And I really think that should have been an entire wraparound narrative, something you keep coming back to in between the archive footage. But the fact that it's only a few minutes long is just one of the structural failings of the filmmaking, I think.
And that obviously Pelé, you first sight of him in this documentary is him sort of coming in with a walker. He can no longer really walk. This hugely vibrant man, athletic man, who he's elderly now, but he is now sort of quite doddery on his feet. It really makes you think, we really do want to hear your story, Pelé.
Exactly.
But he's not prepared to really share it. He doesn't even discuss his real feelings about anything, does he? And I suppose this is born from, as you say, how he behaved during the dictatorship. He wasn't drawn on anything. He remained neutral. He wasn't political in any way. He just got on with life and didn't give anything away, but he's still doing that, and that doesn't make the most interesting documentary. Okay, so that is Pelé, which hits Netflix from February the 23rd. This week is the launch of Star on Disney. What are we going to get on this new channel? What delights are going to be coming into our homes? Tell us, Masana.
It has a very strong selection of television shows, mostly ones that have finished, so you can binge watch them in their entirety if you've been lucky to never see them for the first time. I'm a big fan of Sons of Anarchy, Lost, and 24. I'm also a huge fan of Donald Glover's Atlanta, which is one of the only series on that list that's still on air. Season 3 and Season 4 have been commissioned. They're all TV shows from the American channels Fox, ABC, and FX, all three channels whose programming I follow very closely. However, I have noticed some omissions, including Legion, Justified, The Americans, some of which you'd have to have an Amazon Prime subscription for instead of the Disney Star. My hot tip for listeners, though, would be to check out Terriers. It's a very underrated comedy crime series about a pair of private investigators. I've heard they're best described as The Rockford Files meets The Big Lebowski. Cool. Unfortunately, it wasn't watched by many people, so it was axed after one season.
Oh, you had me at The Rockford Files meets Big Lebowski.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it. And they've also offering a very eclectic selection of films. I love that they have Cleopatra on there, which was an infamous epic disaster starring Elizabeth Taylor in the lead role. Personally, I love the film. It just has an unparalleled opulence to it.
Oh, no, production design on that.
Yeah, and the star power is unreal, you know, having Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor in the same film. But there's five films I want to recommend to listeners, though, that are perhaps less obvious picks than what's on the list. The Namesake, In America, Miller's Crossing, Be Water, and Gross Point Blank.
All corkers. Erlinger, what's tickling your fancy? And are you going to be getting this service?
Well, I already have Disney Plus, so I'm getting it anyway. What struck me is the stuff that's not on there to start with, and I think that's mostly to do with rights issues. For example, we have all the diehards except the first one, and I think it's because someone else in the UK has the rights until later this year. I'm missing Alien from there. I'm missing Alcatraz, if you remember that show, a series about time-traveling criminals that appear in the modern day after disappearing from Alcatraz in the 1960s. That got axed after one season. Millennium is not on there. The series that followed on spiritually from The X-Files as a Chris Carter series. But The X-Files is on there, which is good. And both The X-Files movies, which I hugely enjoyed despite them not being good in any way, shape, or form.
Not being good.
But I enjoy them hugely. And I'm very happy to see them on there. I'm happy to see there's quite a bit of Jeff Goldblum on there as well, including Independence Day, of course, and also his finest film, which is The Fly, and a film called Holy Man, which stars Eddie Murphy and Jeff Goldblum as a very tall man, as Eddie describes him in the film. You can have a nice little Jeff Goldblum night in. I think once more movie rights revert back to Disney, it will feel a little bit less like the MyFive streaming library.
Yeah.
In terms of the films.
Yeah.
Where you get lots of random titles that you haven't heard about in 20 years, and then some gold nuggets in between. It's got a lot of stuff there that will be very good for comfort watching when you can't find out anything else to watch. And then they've got some interesting series coming up, original productions Love Simon, isn't it? Follows on from Love Victor. I'm very intrigued to see how that turns out. And then of course they're developing an Alien TV series that should come in the next 2 years at some point. I'm assuming that will go on Star due to its subject material in the UK. There's some very interesting stuff there, but also a lot of filler.
Well, Disney own everything, so I'm sure everything will come back to roost.
I think it's important for listeners to know, if they don't know already, that with the inclusion of Star, Disney Plus is raising its price from $5.99 to $7.99. They've said, oh, you get 20% off if you subscribe before the 22nd of Feb, but 20% off $7.99. So they actually advertising the new price. It is cheeky, yeah.
Very clever. Very clever, but we're all probably going to just bite that bullet, aren't we? Because who doesn't want another streaming service? Okay, it's time to go now. So before we do, it's time to answer a reader's question. And the question is, in these COVID times, what movie mask would you like to wear? Masana.
For me, the movie mask is quite obvious. And you are seeing this mask being replicated a lot. It has to be Bane for Dark Knight Rises. I mean, the Bane mask is, I've seen so many copycats of those being used. So, yeah.
And then you'd be able to ask for things in a threatening way, wouldn't you? What a lovely, lovely Tesco shop. And, you know, is it cash or card, sir? It'd be a lovely, lovely card. I think I'm sounding a bit more like, I don't know, like an old man from the Werther's advert.
A lot of loyalty for a hired gun!
Or perhaps he's wondering why someone would shoot a man before throwing him out of a plane.
At least you can talk! Who are you?
It doesn't matter who we are. What matters is our plan. No one cared who I was till I put on the mask.
If I pull that off, will you die?
It would be extremely painful.
You're a big guy.
For you.
What about you, Erlinger? What's your favourite mask?
For me, it's hard to look past V for Vendetta, even though it's been hijacked by some undesirable people in the world. I love V for Vendetta. I think it's a striking mask and has a bit of that anti-establishment message to it as well that I like. It's probably not technically valid, but for my stag trip, my friend made a Sam Neill mask for everyone in the group because I'm a Sam Neill super fan. I've got it in my drawer, so I could probably just wear that.
Good. Not alarming at all. In terms of, I think because of the Groundhog Day of this whole lockdown and the boringness, I think I'd have the mask, as in the Jim Carrey mask, and I'd pop that on and I'd just be like singing, dancing, big teeth, sort of shuffling around the place in a lovely suit, causing chaos. I think I'd go for that. Not sure how, you know, in terms of actually stopping any kind of germ contact it would be, but I'd be having fun, which is a change from lockdown. So on that note, we will leave you. We won't be here next week because we're taking a break from the pod because we're running around watching everything at the Glasgow and Berlin film festivals. But please join us on the 4th of March when we'll be back with a bang to discuss nostalgia throwback Coming to America with some very special guests. You can probably guess who. But for now, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your thoughts. You. Let's say goodbye.
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 It's party time! P-A-R-T. Why? Because I gotta!